He doesn't know the full weight of its harm or the despair it can cause. He doesn't know how a single fact about a human being can mean that he and thousands of others like him will die because nobody wants to talk about the disease that is killing them. Nobody wants to spend the money so they won't die. Stupid, arbitrary shit means the President of the United States can wait 6 years before even saying the disease's name. Stupid, arbitrary shit means it will take a movie star to die and a hemophiliac teenager to die before ordinary people start to mobilize, start to feel that the disease needs to be stopped. Tens of thousands of people will die before drugs are made and drugs are approved. What a horrible feeling that is, to know that if the disease had primarily affected PTA presidents or priests or white teenage girls, the epidemic would have ended years earlier and tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of lives would have been saved. We did not choose our identity, but we were chosen to die by it. For stupid, arbitrary reasons instilled by people who refused to see how arbitrary they were. We believe in the golden rule, but we also believe that people fail to live up to it, time and again. Because they fall prey to differences. Because some use the arbitrary very deliberately to keep their own power. We don't burden Avery with this. Why would we want to? There is the hope that the world will get less stupid, less arbitrary, as time goes on. The good thing about human progress is that it tends to move in one direction, and even a fool who looks at the difference between 100 years ago and now can see which direction that is. Moves like an arrow, feels like an equal sign. In the meantime, we are vigilant. Deaths like ours teach you to be vigilant. Avery looks at the river, looks at Ryan on the other side of the boat. The world from here isn't that bad, though, he says. This right now is a world I can live in. This is what the right people can do. They can make you see that better world. There are things they aren't saying, of course. Ryan came down with such a severe eating disorder when he was 13, about the time he was coming out, that the school nurse made him get help. Even his parents don't know, because he swore the nurse and the counselor not to tell. And Avery isn't advertising the fact that he's never been past second base, and the idea of sex petrifies him. Ryan will not confide, not yet, his determination to head far, far away for college, and to never come back to kindling again, not even for weddings or funerals. Avery will not detail the foolish lengths he went to get Freddie Dixon to like him, and how, when it backfired spectacularly, he cut himself for the first and only time in his life. Not everything needs to be said at once. Sharing truth is not the kind of gift that comes in wrapping paper, ripped open once, and there, you're done. No, this is a gift that must be unfolded. It is enough to start the telling. It is enough to have the beginning and feel like it's a beginning. Harry has been kissing Craig for 47 minutes, and he's amazed how easy it is to be kissing Craig again, but without the drama of being boyfriends. It's so much more comfortable now, much less fraught. He'd known all along that they'd get here, that they'd have this. When it was ending, when the boyfriend part was ending, he had been very deliberate about choosing his words. He didn't want to say, "Let's just be friends," or "I hope we can stay friends," because that made friendship sound like a consolation prize, the blue ribbon to look at distractedly while someone else walks off with the gold cup. No, what he said was, "I think you and I will be even closer, and that we will be even better together and more to each other if we're best friends, not boyfriends." He knows it still hurt Craig, and he knows it took some time for Craig to adjust, but he'd been right, hadn't he? They would have never attempted this if they'd been boyfriends. They would have never lasted long enough to get here. And he wouldn't have lasted even 45 minutes if he'd wanted to do anything more than kiss Craig, if Craig turned him on anymore. Maybe there was something at the start, but now it's leveling off. He's glad Craig can't read his mind, because he knows it might be taken as harsh, but really it's a compliment. There are moments when Harry is so revved up, is so horny, that he'd sleep with just about anything. It takes a lot of restraint to realize the damage this can do, and to not venture places where you shouldn't go, even if you're revved up.
He and Craig had fun, for sure, but it was never about sex. And now Harry needs to stop thinking about sex, because his body is starting to react.
So he thinks about something else, about whether he should ask for a sip of water. They're allowed to have some, but only if it's through a straw, and the lips are still touching. Tricky, but it can be done. The problem is, if he drinks now, he runs the risk of having to pee later. And he really wants to avoid that. This is another of the rules. No diapers, no cheating in the bathroom department. If he has to go, he's either got to whip it out and pee on the grass, or just leak a little into his pants. Neither option is really attractive, and the horny edge is totally off his mind now. Craig squeezes his arms, sensing that he's drifting off. Good call. He has to focus on the kiss, not letting go of the kiss. The worst thing he can do is drift off.
There are people all around, but he can't turn to look at any of them.
He has to focus on Craig, and maybe the people over Craig's shoulder. That's it. He loves Craig, it's true. And the number one reason he doesn't want to mess this up is because he wants Craig to have this achievement. He wants to do this for Craig. Because it means more to him. Harry doesn't know why. Maybe because it was Craig's idea, or maybe because he just needs something like this more. Yes, that must be it. Craig needs something like this more. A small crowd is starting to form. People from town walking by, wondering what's going on at the school. Kids from play practice. Some knew this would be happening, but others are learning about it for the first time. Michael is organizing their friends and other people they know to get the word out, to get some cheering going. Some people, mostly adults, are curious enough to come over and look, then are disgusted when they find out what it is. Do their parents know? One woman, walking her poodle, asks, how could they let something like this happen? His parents are right here, Mrs. Ramirez answers fiercely. The woman shakes her head and walks away. Other people, mostly kids, are asking how they can help. Lots of pictures are being taken on lots of phones. One of the kids who asks to pitch in is 11 years old. His name is Max, and his dad brought him to see this. Max is a marvel to us. He will never have to come out because he will have never been kept in. Even though he has a mom and a dad, they made sure from the beginning to tell him that it didn't have to be a mom and a dad. It could be a mom and a mom, a dad and a dad, just a mom, or just a dad. When Max's early affections became clear, he didn't think twice about them. He doesn't see it as defining him. It is just a part of his definition. What does Max see when he looks at Harry and Craig? He sees two boys kissing. But it's not the two boys part that gives him pause. It's the kissing. He can't imagine ever wanting to kiss anyone for that long. Just wait, we want to tell him. Just you wait. After pancakes, Neil and Peter convince Peter's mom to drive them to the Clinton bookshop. There are closer bookstores, but they're in the mood for a drive. Along the way, they don't say much, but their relationship has reached that stage where silence is comfortable, not threatening. Silence only harms when there are things that aren't being said, or when there's the fear that the well is empty and there's nothing left to say. Neither is the case here. They still have plenty to say to each other, just not anything right now. At the bookstore, Neil looks for a doorstop biography to give his father for his birthday, while Peter peruses the young adult section. It is there that Peter's phone buzzes, and he finds a message from his debate friend Simon. There's a link attached. Peter takes a look, then tracks down Neil. "Want to see something awesome?" he asks, showing Neil the message, then clicking the link. "It's two boys in Milburn. They're trying to break the world record for kissing." Neil looks at the grainy feed on the phone. "Do we know either of them?" "I don't think so. But isn't that cool?" Neil thinks it's cool, but his mind is stuck on something he doesn't think is cool at all.
"Hey, beautiful?" he asks.
Peter doesn't get it.
"What?"
"That's how Simon started his text to you. Hey, beautiful?"
"That's just the way Simon talks.
I'm just making an observation."
"Right.
Don't dismiss me like that.
Do we really have to have this conversation again?
Why don't you tell me, beautiful?"
"He's just a flirty friend. We both have flirty friends."
"Yeah, but mine are female."
"Clark? Clark is female?"
"Clark isn't flirty. He's too scientific to be flirty.
He thinks lab partners should have full marriage rights.
The only thing Clark has ever called beautiful in his life is an algebraic equation."
"Oh, but he'd love to see how his X corresponds to your Y."
"Wait, how is this about Clark? I seem to recall it's about Simon."
"Simon is harmless.
Simon is calling you beautiful and sending you a link to two guys kissing?"
"Really?
Of all the places to go, you're going to go there?"
They're a bit too loud. They don't notice the bookseller behind the counter, smiling. He knows firsthand that every relationship falls into this groove at some point. Neil doesn't really think Peter is cheating on him. He doesn't think Peter would ever cheat on him. That's not what this is about. It's about Neil's fear that Peter will want to cheat on him, that he will someday realize there's someone better out there. Peter is young enough to not really understand this. He thinks Neil is being foolish, slightly paranoid. He has done nothing wrong, and resents being attacked anyway.
"Look," he says, "I think we need to step away for a sec. I'm going to go down the street and get coffee. Do you want anything?"
Neil shakes his head.
"Okay, I'll be back in a few minutes," which is hopefully the amount of time it will take for you to realize that even if a million other guys say, "Hey, beautiful," to me, it doesn't change what we are, not one little bit.
"A million? Who said anything about a million?"
"There happen to be a lot of people who use 'Hey, beautiful' as a greeting when I am involved."
"Well, you are beautiful. I grant you that. It must be the 'hey' I object to. It's so common. For horses, really. And you are so uncommonly, unhorsily beautiful."
Peter realizes this last twist in the conversation means things with Neil are curving back into being better, but now that he's mentioned coffee, he wants it. So he heads out, gets an iced latte, drinks it in a few gulps, too many damn ice cubes, then heads back to the bookstore. He finds Neil still in the YA section, his arms full of books.
"Wow," Peter says. "Are they putting you on bed rest or something?"
Neil puts the books on a table and shushes Peter with a finger to his lips. Then he picks up the first book and holds it so Peter can read the title.
"I hadn't meant to tell you this."
Peter quiets, watches as Neil holds up the books one by one.
"Just listen.
Stay.
You're the one that I want.
So much closer.
Where I want to be.
The difference between you and me.
Positively.
Matched.
Perfect.
Wonder.
You are here.
Where I belong.
I'll be there.
Along for the ride.
The future of us.
Real live boyfriends.
Keep holding on."
When Neil is through, Peter smiles and holds up his hand, gesturing Neil to wait there, to not say a word. He picks out two books from the YA section, then runs to the fiction section for a third. He is still smiling when he returns to Neil and shows his selections one by one.
"Take a bow.
A blind man can see how much I love you.
Keep holding on."
Peter makes a stack of his books and takes a picture of the spines to send to Neil. Neil then does the same for Peter. They put a few of the books back on the shelves and buy a few of them. They'd buy them all, if only they had the money to do so. As they map their way in ribbons through the store, as they traverse the alphabetical and the topical and the arcane, we are reminded of bookstores where we went, of coffee shops and sex shops and Barney's and the Piggly Wiggly, all the aisles where we navigated relationships, all the conversations that were part of the aggregate conversation of our love. It isn't until they're in the back of Peter's mom's car that Neil remembers the two boys kissing in Milburn. With his permission, Neil takes Peter's phone and clicks on the link again. Neither one of them can believe it. Right there, in the town next to theirs, two boys kissing for hours in front of the high school. "Not your typical Saturday," Peter says. "No," Neil agrees, "not at all." Cooper had to leave Walmart after he bumped into Sloan, so now he's at a Starbucks a few towns away. It's full of people who are the same type of people who go to his high school and live in his town, but they're not the same people. Cooper feels anonymous, and that suits him fine. He's flipping through three different hookup apps, finding a lot of the same guys on each one. 47-year-olds who want him to come over. 18-year-olds who want to flirt aimlessly. 29-year-olds who want to know what he's into. He never starts the conversations. He never picks them out. It means more if they come to him, because that means he's desirable. And if he's desirable, he has the upper hand. We think he is too young to know this. But he knows this. You learn it now at a much younger age. By now, he's seen that there are at least a dozen messages on his phone, all from his parents. The house line. Each of their cell phones. He's not going to listen to them, and he's not going to call them back. He is blacking all that out. It is on the other side of the barrier. He doesn't know where he's going to sleep tonight, but it's not tonight yet, is it? He's sure some people would think it's denial, but it's not. He doesn't care. In order to be in denial, you have to in some way care. All he feels is the bored emptiness of the flat, flat world. And there's no one who bores him more than himself. He looks again at the men on the apps, and this time a new one has popped up. 23, hot. His screen name is Antimatter. His stats are the right stats. His one line of description is, trying to find the sensible strain in the midst of all the chaos. Cooper waits for 5 minutes. He wants Antimatter to contact him first. But he's impatient. After 5 minutes, he thinks, fine. He goes ahead and makes the first move. The question in Avery's mind is whether or not they'll kiss. They've been on the boat for a couple of hours now. They've talked, they've paddled, they've talked some more. As the sun angles closer to the horizon, it's getting warmer. The canoe is metal, and it's becoming hot to the touch. They haven't brought anything to drink or eat, and the sun is starting to make them drowsy. Avery wishes the boat was wide enough for them to sit next to each other. It's so much easier to kiss when you're right there. I think I'm starting to bake. Ryan says, maybe we should go in. Avery agrees. They start to paddle in earnest, and Avery is startled by the satisfaction he feels as he levers through the water, how gratifying it is to push through the resistance, to feel the effort in his arms. He is still a long way from being proud of his body, but sometimes a movement will catch him the right way. The air cools as they move, but their bodies remain warm. They find their tandem and row in rhythm. Not a word needs to be said. When they get back to the dock, they both have to wipe the sweat from their foreheads. Ryan jumps out first and ties down the bow. Then he holds out his hand to Avery. Even though he's an overheated mess, Avery takes it. Ryan pulls him onto the dock and keeps hold. They stand there, the canoe clanking against the dock in the slight tide. That was fun, the blue-haired boy says. It was, the pink-haired boy replies. These words are inadequate. Ryan keeps hold of Avery's hand as he ties down the stern. Then he rises back up and turns their bodies so they're face to face, toe to toe. Hey, a voice calls out. Ryan's aunt coming down from the house. How is the river? She walks a little closer, sees how they've moved a little bit apart, but are still holding hands. They're not looking at each other now. They're looking at her. So Ryan, she says, are you going to introduce me to your friend? I'm guessing you boys are thirsty. I have just the thing. Just the thing. Another hour has passed, and Harry and Craig remain in their kiss. More people gather. Mr. Nickel, a science teacher, takes over from Ms. Luna. There are now 2,000 people on the live feed. Tariq hands Harry and Craig their phones so they can tweet and respond to the comments on the feed. Already it's gone global. People in Germany are sending in encouragement. A boy in Helsinki has made a sign that reads, "Go, kissers, go!" Some of the gay blogs have picked up on what's happening. Word is spreading. Harry loves responding to the comments, but mostly he's concerned that his feet are starting to hurt, and it's only been 4 hours. He leans on Craig and shakes them out. Then the sun starts to hit, and he shapes his hand into a U, so Smitta will come and hold an umbrella over his back, making sure not to get in the way of the camera. There are backups from other angles, but everyone feels it's important that the primary feed should only be blocked in emergencies. He and Craig are both wearing old people socks to try to keep the blood flowing in their feet. But the bottom line is that being upright for a long time is not how the body is supposed to work. Already he feels like he's at a standing room only concert, and there have been 7 opening acts. The song "Dream a Little Dream of Me" comes on Tariq's playlist, which makes Harry think of the movie Beautiful Thing, as Tariq no doubt knew it would. Harry can feel Craig smile under his lips and knows he must be sharing the same thought. As confirmation, Harry feels Craig's finger on his back, tracing the letter B, then T. They start to shuffle and slow dance. It feels good to move their legs. Smitta steps back with the umbrella, and Tariq steps in and starts to dance with her. Mr. and Mrs. Ramirez step in as well. Other people look like they want to join in, but Rachel, watching the cameras, tells them they need to keep clear, not get in the way. The police officer who's been assigned to watch over things offers to get some caution tape. Rachel says that might be a good idea, but asks if there's any way it can avoid saying caution. The officer says she'll see what she can do. It feels so good to Harry to be dancing. It makes him so happy to see his parents smiling as they sway. He wants to sing along, but knows he can't. He holds Craig lightly, and they glide in a slow circle. Craig's eyes are closed. Harry's are opened. Which is how Harry sees her first. Craig feels Harry stop. He feels Harry clasp him tighter. He traces a question mark on Harry's back. But there is no way for Harry to respond. He only kisses Craig closer, puts his hand on the back of Craig's neck, warning him to stay focused, warning him not to turn. Then Craig hears it. His name. His mother's voice. His name. We all turn to her. She is a small woman who until 10 minutes ago thought Craig was on a camping trip for the weekend. She looks more confused than angry, and we wish there were a way that we could explain it to her. We want to pull her aside and tell her everything we know, everything our mothers did wrong, everything our mothers did right. Your son is alive, we want to tell her. Your son is living. She doesn't understand why he isn't answering. She doesn't understand why he goes on kissing this other boy, even though she is standing right behind him, saying his name. Mrs. Meehan called me and started to talk to me, and I had no idea what she was talking about. Craig wants to turn around. He wants to try to explain. But he feels Harry's hand on the back of his neck. He remembers why he's here. They are already too far along. He can't reset it.
Craig. His mother's voice is cracking.
It's Smitta who steps forward. She lets go of the umbrella and walks over to Craig's mother.
He can't say anything, she says. They have to keep kissing.
Craig's mother knows Smitta. She's known Smitta for a long time. Smitta is the only thing that makes sense to her now. It is only vaguely that she understands the crowd, understands the cameras.
What's happening?
She asks, her voice the thinnest of lines. This was not the way she was supposed to find out. Craig feels the tears starting in his eyes. He tries to stop them, but it's too much. They leak down his cheeks. Harry holds on. Craig shudders, and Harry presses his mouth closer. This was not how it was supposed to be. He'd imagined telling them after. Somehow, he believed it could be kept a secret until it was over. He'd have this big accomplishment, and then he could tell them. He imagined gathering them in the den, sitting his parents and his brothers down on the couch while he stood in front of them and told them, like when he was little and he'd put on one-man shows for them right before bed. And whatever happened, they wouldn't be able to take anything away from him. They wouldn't be able to erase anything he'd done.
But he wasn't thinking about them, about what it would be like to be in that audience. He realizes it with such shock.
He wasn't thinking about them at all. Few of us did. It was our revelation, our event. How could we know that they had a right to feel things too? They had no right to deny us, but they had every right to feel things. He gets this all from the sound of her voice, the way she said his name. Harry's parents have never met Craig's parents. Harry's mother comes over to Craig's mother now and introduces herself. She and Smitta try to tell her what's happening. They tell her about the world record, tell her what Craig and Harry are trying to achieve.
But I don't understand, Craig's mother says, crying now too. I don't understand.
Craig can't bear it. He opens his eyes, looks over to Tariq, who has tears in his own eyes. He mimes writing. Tariq scrambles for a marker and some paper. He runs it over to Craig. All the things Craig has to say boil down to the essential. It's the thing that neither Smitta nor Mrs. Ramirez can say. It's within everything they're saying, but they can't unfold it for Craig's mother, can't spell out the foundation. I'm gay, Mom. I'm gay. Craig rotates his and Harry's body so he's facing his mother. Then he holds up his shaky sign. He sees her eyes as she understands it. Then, quickly, he writes another sign. I can't stop now. I'm sorry. He is not sorry for being gay, but he is endlessly sorry that this is how she's found out. Or maybe not found out. She doesn't seem entirely surprised by the revelation, only in the way it's being revealed. Only in the way it's being confirmed. She's asking Smitta if this is Craig's boyfriend, and Smitta, poor friend, doesn't know what the better answer is, so she goes with the truth and says, no, that's not what this is about. Harry and Craig are friends. They are kissing to show the world that it's okay for two boys to kiss. Mr. Ramirez brings over a chair so Craig's mother can sit down.
It's a lot to process, he says.
At this point, some of our mothers would have laughed, would have said, understatement of the year. Others would have said, fuck you, and stormed away. Still others did exactly what Craig's mother does now, falling silent, falling completely into the sound of her own thoughts, which can't be heard from the outside. Mrs. Ramirez tries to hold her hand, give her support. Craig's mother pulls her hand away. Craig is twisting in place, a bystander to one of the most important moments of his life. Harry understands this and loosens his grip. If you need to go, it's okay. But what can Craig say? And if he lets go now, all of this will have been for nothing. He lets the paper and marker fall to the grass. He wraps his arms around Harry and pulls him in for a real kiss, a true kiss. His tears run down his cheeks, into their mouths. Don't let go. The crowd cheers. Craig and Harry had forgotten they were there. Tariq can't stand it. He feels it's in some way his fault, too. He plants himself right there in front of Craig's mother and says, "You need to love him. I don't care who you thought he was or who you want him to be. You need to love him exactly as he is because your son is a remarkable human being. You have to understand that." And Craig's mother whispers back, "I know. I know." This time it's Smitta who takes her hand, and she doesn't pull away. "It's okay," Smitta says. "He's fine. Everything's fine." Harry can feel Craig going slack and catches him. All that tension suddenly released in sobs. Harry keeps his mouth on top of Craig's. They do not break the kiss. Some of our parents were always on our side. Some of our parents chose to banish us rather than see us for who we were. And some of our parents, when they found out we were sick, stopped being dragons and became dragon slayers instead. Sometimes that's what it takes, the final battle. But it should take much, much less than that. For 14 minutes, she sits in the chair, watching her son kiss this other boy. Smitta does not leave her side, but she doesn't try to talk to her either. She lets her take it in, lets her feel it through. At first, Craig can't face his mother. He and Harry stand so that she is seeing their profiles, out of their sight lines. But eventually he has to see her. So he shifts them around, dances a quarter turn, and looks at her over Harry's shoulders. Their eyes meet and hold for a few seconds as Craig forgets to breathe. They both start crying again, but it doesn't seem as desperate as before, as devastating. There are all these moments you don't think you will survive. And then you survive. There are so many things Harry wants to say to Craig, all of the comforting words that gather on the inside of his mouth but must remain unsaid. We know how he feels because we gather those words inside us every single day, knowing what we know now, seeing what we see now. But at least Harry can hold him. At least Harry can give him strength that way. And then he realizes there's another thing he can do. He makes the sign for phone, and then, after Tariq has given him his phone, he makes the gesture for phone again and points to Craig. Tariq is confused, but Rachel understands. She brings Craig's phone over to him and opens it to the message page. Over his shoulder, Harry texts him. "It's better this way. It's going to be okay." Craig texts back, "I think I know that, but it's hard." Harry knows the answer, but he has to ask anyway. "Do you want to stop and talk to her?" Craig shakes his head slightly, their lips still touching. "No, we're going to do this." Meanwhile, Harry's mother has brought her own phone over to show Craig's mother the thousands of comments that have been left in support of Harry and Craig so far. There are close to 4,000 people watching, cheering them on. "I know you don't know me," Harry's mother tells her, "but we definitely have something in common." This time when she offers her hand, Craig's mother holds it, squeezes it once before letting go. It is hard to stop seeing your son as a son and to start seeing him as a human being. It is hard to stop seeing your parents as parents and to start seeing them as human beings. It is a two-sided transition, and very few people manage it gracefully. It's sometimes easier with aunts. Ryan's aunt Caitlin gives Avery and Ryan some pink lemonade and some freshly baked oatmeal raisin cookies. Countless times, Ryan has sat at this kitchen table when the world has felt like too much for him, when he's wanted to sit inside a house that fully felt like a home. We've all done this, created our mix-and-match families, our homemade safety nets. This table, he thinks, has seen so much of his anguish. But now, with Avery, it's witnessing the opposite of anguish. The table's presence makes it more real because it makes it more a part of Ryan's life. Caitlin is the girl we would have let ourselves be paired with if we were going to be paired with a girl. After years of trying to rise in the world of corporate insurance, she quit and is now going for her library degree. Her sense of humor is indistinguishable from her sense of self, and her love for Ryan is the most unconditional love he will ever feel. It is unfreighted by expectations, untempered by motives. All she has to do is like him and love him, and both are things she does well. Her responsibility to him is completely voluntary, and that's what makes it matter. Avery wants to make a good impression and is too nervous to realize this won't be hard. When Caitlin asks how they met, he turns it into the longest story in the history of humankind, telling her everything short of the amount of gas that was left in his tank after the drive home to Marigold. Halfway through, he knows he's talking too much, but Ryan and Caitlin don't seem to notice it as much as he does, so he goes on. When it's over, Caitlin asks, "And this was how many weeks ago?" It's Ryan who smiles and says, "This was all last night." "It makes sense," Caitlin says. "With some people, the minute you start talking, it feels like you've known them for years. It only means that you were supposed to meet sooner. You're feeling all the time you should have known each other, but didn't. That time still counts. You can definitely feel it." Avery knows he should be trying to get Ryan away, should be trying to get him alone, get him close enough to kiss. Time is quietly ticking down to the moment he'll have to leave. He promised his mother he'd be home before dark. But he is enjoying the company, the lemonade, the cookies. He feels it's probably wrong to think of this as more worthy than kissing and making out. But right now, it is. "Do you want to see some embarrassing photos of Ryan dressed up as Britney Spears for Halloween?" Caitlin asks. How can Avery say no? Meanwhile, Cooper has been chatting with Antimatter for almost an hour. As far as Antimatter knows, Cooper is a 19-year-old student at the local community college. He is majoring in finance and has two roommates, one of whom is a drunk. Antimatter doesn't question this and says that he's just gotten his own place and is working as the manager of a coffee shop. He's a painter, too, but there hasn't been much money in that so far. Cooper used to want to be a painter and finds himself telling Antimatter this. Antimatter asks what happened, and Cooper says he lost interest. "Story of my life," Cooper tells him. Antimatter responds, "Story isn't over yet." Cooper is a little interested and a little bored. To up the ante, he sends a shirtless pic to Antimatter, and Antimatter responds in kind. He's got a great body. Cooper asks him if he wants to meet up. Antimatter says, "Sure, maybe after dinner." Cooper wonders what dinner plans Antimatter has, but doesn't ask. He just says that'd be fine. He suggests the Starbucks he's sitting in. Antimatter says that will work, as long as they don't have to drink the coffee. Cooper, who's already had three, is okay with that. Now that the date is set, Antimatter says he should probably do some IRL things. But before I go, what's your name?
Drake,
Cooper answers. Hi, Drake. I'm Julian. Cooper can't help it. He liked him better as Antimatter. But he doesn't cancel the meetup. It would be stupid to cancel over something as dumb as a name.
When you have been dead as long as we have, you begin to see all the angles that existed in your life, especially the ones you were too blind to see at the time. You have plenty of time to chart the paths of your major and minor mistakes, and to have a newfound sympathy for the mistakes other people make. At times we were helpless, it's true, but other times we were heartless. We screwed ourselves up, screwed other people over, said words we didn't know would hurt, said words precisely because we knew they would wound. Even after what we went through, no retroactive saintliness can be granted. We understand our fuck-ups more now from a distance, but that doesn't make them any less real. You must understand, we were like Cooper. Or at least we had moments when we were like Cooper. Just as we had moments when we were like Neil, Peter, Harry, Craig, Tariq, Avery, Ryan. We had moments when we were like each of you. This is how we understand. We wore your flaws. We wore your fears. We made your mistakes. 6 hours and 10 minutes into Harry and Craig's kiss, a popular blogger with hair an even brighter pink than Avery's posts about Harry and Craig and tells the world to get behind what they're doing. The number of people viewing the kiss goes from 3,928 to 40,102 within 5 minutes, and then to 103,039 5 minutes after that. At the same time this is happening, Craig's mother stands up from her chair and walks over to him. She asks Smitta if it's possible for her to remain off camera and for the sound to be turned off while she is speaking to her son. Smitta passes the request to Tariq, who obliges.
I need to get back home, Craig's mother tells him. Your father and your brothers will be home soon, and I should be there.
She pauses. It is clear from his eyes that Craig is listening, even though he is kissing Harry at the same time.
I hope you realize that I'm going to have to tell them what you're doing. If they find out from anyone else, it will be worse. Do you understand?
Craig wants to say yes, knows he could make his voice say, uh-huh, at the very least, but that doesn't feel right. The sign they agreed upon for yes is a thumbs up, which also feels wrong. But Craig can't think of anything else, so he gives his mother a thumbs up. Craig's mother takes a deep breath. She is not finished. After she exhales, she says, in a voice as level as she can manage, I love you, Craig. I am also very angry at you. Not because you are gay. We will deal with that. But to find out this way, it's not what I would have wanted. I'm sure you had your reasons, and I hope you will be willing to talk about them with us when this whole thing is through.
Again, Craig gives his mother a thumbs up. He feels ridiculous. His mother's expression softens. Do you need anything? She asks.
For a moment, Craig's heart feels entirely porous. Not because his mother has asked such a monumental question, but because it's such an ordinary one. This is the mother he knows. Do you need anything? As if she were running to Walgreens or the grocery store. As if nothing has changed. There is no way for Craig to say, I need you to convince Dad and Sam and Kevin that this is fine. I need you to support me as much as Harry's parents support him. I need you to be proud of what I'm doing, because it will matter so much more if you are. I need you to come back. I need to know that neither of us is going to drown from this.
His fingers make an okay sign.
All right, then, she says. I'll go. He wants her to come over and hug him, or at least put her hand on his shoulder. But instead she turns and starts her walk home. Harry, sensing what's happening, starts to switch their positions so Craig doesn't have to see her go. But Craig holds firm. He watches as she says goodbye to Smitta, not to Harry's parents, not to anyone else, just to Smitta, and then steps into the crowd. They all face forward, but she faces home. He watches as she becomes a small shape on the sidewalk, then moves out of his sightline. It is about a 10-minute walk home from here, and he's sure his heartbeat will count off the steps until she gets there. Then it will stop. It is only after she is gone, only after he pictures her alone, walking, that his vision draws back closer. For the first time since she arrived, he realizes how thick the crowd has become. There are so many unfamiliar faces here, as well as familiar ones. Someone starts a chant, "Harry and Craig, all the way, Harry and Craig, all the way." He knows he should be taking strength from this, that he should be encouraged. But the truth is, he has left his body for a little while. He is hovering over his house, too far up in the air to see his mother return, too human to see through the ceiling or hear through the wind how the conversation in his parents' bedroom goes. Peter and Neil are in Peter's room, watching the live feed online. "Was that his mother?" Peter asks.
"I think so,"
Neil says. "They cut in so fast, it was hard to tell, but I think it was." "Do you think she knew about it ahead of time?"
"From the way she looked before, probably not."
Neil can imagine his own mother looking the same way, and is trying not to think about that.
"How long do you think we could last?" Peter asks. "Having a son like Craig? Pretty long, I think."
"Ha ha. I mean kissing."
"Not 32 hours,
but a few hours." "Here." Peter pulls Neil off his desk chair, stands him in the middle of the room. "Let's try."
"Right this moment?
No time like the present." Before Neil can protest, Peter kisses him and stays there. For the first minute or two, it feels totally normal. The tender pressure, tongues corresponding, hands tracing spines, gliding down hips. Then comes the moment in the rhythm when they would usually take a breath, smile, or say something, or pull back so fingers could trail down. They move through the pause, draw out their ardor. Peter lingers his hand down Neil's back, slips his fingers beneath his waistband, rests on the skin there, the heat. Neil moves in the opposite direction, his hand rising under the back of Peter's shirt, between his shoulder blades. Peter still tastes like coffee and milk. Neil tastes like winter mint. Peter's breath staggers a little in his lungs. Neil touches the nape of his neck, then slowly retreats back down, fingernails raking skin. They are hyper-conscious of their bodies, hyper-conscious of their breathing. Peter brings his hand around, lifts his palm to Neil's heartbeat. Minutes pass. Their bodies grow hotter. Their kiss is wetter. Peter's stubble presses prickly against Neil's chin. Peter feels the silence of the room, the lack of music. Their hips lock against each other. Neil's breath quickens. Peter's underwear grows tighter. Neither wants to be the one who pulls away. 11 minutes. 12 minutes. Peter loses track of his breathing, exhales when he should inhale. Instinctively, he pulls back for more breath, and just like that, the kiss is broken. The moment it breaks, Neil lets his arms fall. They step away from each other. They look at the clock.
"That was intense," Peter says, adjusting his jeans.
"Yeah," Neil says, wiping some saliva from his stubble suffering chin. They turn back to the screen, see Harry and Craig in their dance. Peter is about to say something else, but his father calls up to say that dinner is ready. It's time to come down. Avery can try to ignore the clock, but it's harder to ignore the sun. He and Ryan say goodbye to Caitlin, each of them giving her a hug and a kiss on the cheek. Avery's already called home, looking for an extension. But he's only had a license for a little while and has never driven at night on the highway before. His mother doesn't want his first time to be alone, and it's hard to argue with that. But he will push dusk as late as it can go, knowing that even after sunset, there's a gap before the entire sky goes the shade of night. Ryan has him pull over a couple of minutes before his house will appear. "This is a good spot," he tells Avery. "I don't want to say goodbye in front of my house, if you know what I mean." Avery thinks he knows what Ryan means, knows what Ryan wants to do, and immediately all of his senses are reaching out for it. The radio is on low, the dashboard glowing dimly in the increasing twilight. "I've had a great time," Avery says, because he feels it needs to be said. "Me too," Ryan murmurs, and it is the shift into that murmur that marks the turning within the car. Avery suddenly feels that he is breathing electric air, and it is through this air that Ryan is leaning. Avery leans into it too, leans into all of it, and that is when their lips touch for the first time. That is the consecration of everything they've already known. This is what we don't admit about first kisses. One of the most gratifying things about them is that they are proof, actual proof, that the other person wants to kiss us. We are desirable. We desire. Every kiss that matters contains a recognition at its core. Cooper returns to Starbucks a few minutes before 7:30, just in case antimatter, Julian, is early. In the interim, he's gone to Subway for dinner, and now he's finally checking his messages. Well, the first message, which is a mistake. "You had better get your ass back here right now if you know what's good for you. I will drag you back here myself if I have..." Cooper hits delete. Then he hits delete 13 more times. We want to shake him. We want to tell him what we learned from blunt experience. While you have to listen to the first message, it's the most recent message that matters the most. Tempers can calm. Rage can wear itself out. Sense can return. We're not saying he should go back. We know that's a hard choice. But we think he needs to hear the most recent message before he decides. All of the messages are from his father or his mother. No one else has called. It's gotten to the point that Cooper barely notices this. Julian is 4 minutes late. He looks like his photo on the app, which is a relief. Cooper is sure the person in the photo don't always match. Since he's never actually met someone from online before, he's had no experience one way or the other. He knows he looks like his own photo. It's only the words that are lies. "Hey there," Julian says. Cooper can't tell if he's nervous. We can tell he is. "Hey," Cooper says back, casual, like he does this all the time. Julian remains standing. "Do you want to go somewhere else? Somewhere less Starbucks?" "Like where?" Cooper asks. It comes out as a challenge. "I don't know. I'm sorry. I should have thought about that. A drink, maybe? Oh, wait. That won't work." "Why?" "Your age?" "I might be 19, but I'm still up for a drink." "Do you have an ID?" "No, but we don't have to go to a bar." "So where..." Julian begins. Then he gets it. "I'm not sure we should go to my place. Not yet." "Why don't we stay here for a little while, then? You don't have to buy anything. I'll just get a latte and we can talk, okay?" Like that, Cooper's taken charge. And he gets a charge from that. It's enough for now to balance out his disappointment. Cooper figures this guy isn't a dream, and he isn't a nightmare. He's just more of the same, better probably than Cooper feels he deserves. But at least there's the possibility that the night will go a little differently than it usually does. The sun retreats from the sky, and the light around Harry and Craig darkens. The lamps above them go on, and it's a harsher light than Tariq had imagined it would be. If you look on the feed, Harry and Craig appear to be bleached-out blurs immersed in shadow. The drama club springs to action. Most of them have stayed here after rehearsal, cheering on Harry and Craig. The head of the tech crew calls their advisor for permission, then instructs his squad to start running more extension cords from the school. Tariq is consulted, and spotlights are obtained. The tech crew works quietly. Smita expresses gratitude, and they are almost embarrassed by it. It's one of the rules of tech crew. If you are nice to them, they will help you. If you are mean to them, if you push them into lockers, if you call them names, if you make it clear you think less of them, then they will burn you the first chance they get, and they will enjoy it. Harry and Craig have always been cool to them, so they're pitching in. Within an hour, the whole place is rigged. Harry is grateful for the distraction. His feet feel like uncomfortable blocks of cement, no matter how often he moves them. He is also starting to feel his eyelids grow heavier, so he signals an E and gets an energy drink. It's a tricky operation, kissing Craig and sipping from a straw at the same time. But Craig makes sure Harry's covered, and gets more than a few drops of energy drink in his own mouth as a result. Almost immediately, Harry can feel his heart race as the drink goes through his system. He'll be good for a few hours, and then might need another boost. Luckily, his bladder is behaving. Craig is upset, but not surprised, that his mother hasn't returned. That must have been his father's order. To ignore. To deny. He could text her. He could beg her to come back. He could ask her what's going on. But he stops himself. His parents have to figure it out themselves, because he's not the one with the problem. They are. Harry senses him drifting. He pulls Craig closer, kisses him like he means it, kisses him to draw him back. People cheer, but not everyone. At this point, there are people in the crowd who aren't smiling at all. Their disgust would be visible to anyone next to them if the people next to them were watching. But for now, they are invisible, except to us. We see them, and we have no doubt they will not stay invisible, not for long. The night pushes on.
"Don't mind the mess," Julian says as he turns the key in the door.
Cooper promises he won't. He'd bet his room is messier anyway. Sure enough, when he gets in the apartment, he doesn't know what Julian's talking about. Everything seems to be in order. It's not that big a place, but it's not like there's underwear everywhere or pipes leaking through the ceiling. There are canvases in various states of completion all over the living room. Julian sees Cooper looking and feels the need to explain.
"It's just the way I work. I'll spend an hour on one thing, then switch to something else, then switch again. I'm usually working on at least 20 paintings at the same time. Very ADD, I know. But I've tried doing it the other way, and the paintings get tired."
Cooper gestures at the painting on the easel.
"Is that your mom or something?"
Julian blushes.
"No, it's actually Joni Mitchell. I listen to her a lot when I paint, so I figured I'd return the favor, although I'm not sure she'd appreciate the gesture. Did you know she's a painter too?"
Cooper clearly has no idea what Julian's talking about, and when Julian realizes this, he blushes further.
"I'm being a bad host," he says. "I haven't even offered you a drink yet, Drake. What do you want?"
Cooper almost trips up on that Drake. He's forgotten that's his name right now. But he recovers quickly and asks for a Jack and Coke. He's never really had a drink with anyone else before, just in the company of his dad's liquor cabinet when his parents have been away. Jack and Coke is the first thing that comes to his mind.
"It might have to be a Jack and Diet Coke," Julian says. "Let me check."
He goes into the kitchen and yells out,
"Yeah, Diet Coke."
"That's fine," Cooper yells back. Cooper can hear the ice maker doing its work, then the clink of ice cubes being dropped into glasses, and the release of the Diet Coke bottle when its cap is turned. He looks at some of the paintings and likes them more than he thought he would. Julian isn't bad at all. And there's something he likes about the way all of the paintings are unfinished. It seems more real that way. People are caught between being sketches and being complete. Cooper has no idea who any of them are.